Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, and this is First Coast Connect. Today, a measles outbreak exposes the demise of public health in Florida. I'm joined by three experts to trace what has happened to the state in the days from the HIV/AIDS crisis to the aftermath of COVID. Later in the program, giving Old Arlington its due, a community group explores the city's largest suburb by land and sea. But first, children in Florida have been getting ill from an entirely preventable illness. But my guests today say the measles outbreak is a symptom of a much deeper malady in the state's public health system. I'm joined now by Dr. Paul Ahrens, a retired family physician with four decades of experience, including as the former HIV/AIDS medical director at the Florida Department of Health. Welcome, Dr. Ahrens.
Thank you. It's very good to be with you.
Also, good morning. Also, Dr. Leslie Beisch, a faculty member at the FSU College of Medicine and former director of the Oklahoma State Department of Health, as well as the deputy secretary of the Florida Department of Health. Dr. Beisch, thank you for being here. And, I've got to pick it. Hey, good morning, Dr. Beisch. That was my bad. Welcome.
Thank you.
We also welcome Dr. Jeffrey Goldhagen, professor in the Division of Community Pediatrics at the UF College of Medicine and former director of the local health department from 1993 to 2005. Welcome.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks for being here. We're also welcome your calls and comments. We're tackling a big topic today, and we invite you to reach out on social media or email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. You can also give us a call at 904-549-2937. Dr. Goldhagen, let's start with what's happening right now with measles in Florida. In classrooms and pediatricians' offices, the numbers are small, but what are we seeing?
Well, what's happening with the measles outbreak is the proverbial canary in the coal mine. We have not responded to measles in the way it should be responded to. Our Surgeon General has not only not followed accepted public health practices, but has actually suggested the antithesis of those. Measles is one example. We had a devastating response in this state to COVID. Because of policies by the governor and by our Surgeon General. So over the past decades, but in particular accelerated now, public health has been gutted in the state, and individuals across the state are at great risk.
And so the numbers, as I said, they're small. There's just about 60 or so cases nationwide, I believe, according to the latest CDC numbers. Florida has the second most number of cases, just 10. And the state says it's under control, but I'm curious, you know, this is a reflection of overall declining vaccination rates. Explain how that plays into why we're seeing measles cases at all.
Well, the primary role of public health is to protect and promote health and to generate the policies in order to do so. And so at this point in time, the health department, Department of Health from the state and at the local levels, which are now controlled by the state, are neither protecting or promoting vaccinations. They're not protecting health. Our Surgeon General has come out against vaccinations. He's come out against the appropriate and routine quarantine practices. And so whether it's measles today or the next COVID pandemic tomorrow, this state and this Surgeon General and this governor has gutted the public health response. And at this point in time, public health cannot protect the citizens of this state and certainly cannot promote health.
Dr. Beisch, how did the state Surgeon General respond to this recent outbreak specifically? I mean, he sent a letter to parents, is that right, who were in these affected schools?
No, that's correct. He said it was their decision whether or not to be vaccinated or to send their children back to school. And again, as Dr. Goldhagen indicated just a moment ago, that's contrary to recommendations that have been in place for decades. And ironically for me, I began my public health career as a medical director of the health department in Broward County. And we had a measles outbreak in, must have been 1989 or 1990, which we responded to in a very different way and rapidly interrupted the spread of the pathogen. If you've not been vaccinated and you're exposed to measles, there's a way higher than 90% chance that you will, in fact, develop measles. And Broward, in 1989, was an international community. It's even more so today. So you've got people coming into the state of Florida, and Broward and Dade and Duval and, you know, our left coast in Hillsborough counties and Pinellas counties, they're international destinations, and not being vaccinated really places people at risk. And so the idea that you would not vaccinate people is public health malpractice, but then that you would allow kids to go back to school during the period where they need to be removed from the school if they don't wish to be vaccinated so as not to expose others. That's really a dangerous thing to do. People die from measles. This is not a trivial disease. Most people handle it well, but there are all kinds of complications from having an active case of measles.
Dr. Paul Aaron, you're a family doctor. I doubt you've seen much in the way of measles. I mean, I think most of us think of measles as being fairly well eliminated from the U.S. Since 2000. But it does have very serious consequences, as Dr. Beisch was saying. What do you know about measles in your practice?
Well, I was born before 1957, which I think was the cutoff date. They say that people are often have natural immunity. I had measles when I was a child and did not have any serious sequelae, but a case of measles can range into some very serious problems, including pneumonia and encephalitis and so on. So, and there can be after effects as well. I think just to add a little bit of information, the 10 cases that have been reported in Florida, 9 of them were in Broward County, as Dr. Beisch was alluding to. One was in Polk County. And those cases, as far as we know, are now resolved. I don't think there have been any new cases reported, save this week, the way there have been in Chicago. But I think what struck me about the response was, first of all, that there was some sensitivity on the part of the governor, feeling that there was undue attention being paid to the outbreak in Florida. And, you know, I think he feels like Florida is being stigmatized or somehow because of the COVID controversies and so on, that undue attention is being paid to us. But I think that's symbolic of what's been going on in public health in this state, not just during the DeSantis administration, but in the Rick Scott administration. And even before, which is that public health has been politicized. And for example, and this historically, for example, there was a tuberculosis outbreak that the Duval County residents probably remember well. And right at that time, the Department of Health was being reorganized through the legislature, and the TB hospital in Lantana was being sold. Those are the kinds of things that I wouldn't say that the Department of Health has been totally gutted, but I would say that there are all sorts of warning signs, as Dr. Goldhagen alluded to, that we have suboptimal type of public health responses. There's a lot of expertise. There's a lot of resources still in the county health departments and in Tallahassee at headquarters, but I think they're in danger.
I want to come back to the state's response, but we're getting a couple of questions that I want to get to. Junior on Facebook says, this is a reflection of politics and rhetoric that comes from the top down, playing into the dispersion of disinformation and misinformation. This all came from the top. When the COVID-19 pandemic first broke out, it's sad that public health is looked at by many as unimportant. And Junior on X, I believe that's the same comment actually duplicated. We have a call also from Joe in Atlantic Beach. Good morning, Joe. Welcome to the program.
Oh, good morning. Great show. Thank you for taking my call. And we know that measles is a zoonotic disease, and it's a shame to see at farmers market birds and animals being sold openly, and these animals are crammed in cages. And we know bird flu is raging, and 75% of all emergent infectious diseases are coming from animals. So what is being done to prevent the next zoonotic pandemic?
Good comment question, Joe. To that point, I mean, there are a lot of, you know, risks out there. Dr. Goldhagen, there's a lot of illnesses out there. I want to just kind of touch on the administration's response. We did reach out to the Department of Health and the governor. We haven't yet heard back, and we certainly will update you if we do hear back. But I think that their perspective would be their response in the specific case was to an outbreak at a school, and that the Surgeon General was giving parents, kind of giving some element of parental choice, which has been, I think, a mantra of this administration, instead of a directive. What do you think, when it comes to public health, how much room is there for parental choice in that equation? How does public health allow for a dialogue with parents as opposed to directives? Or is that the business of public health to issue directives?
No, the business of public health is to engage the community. But one of the reorganization aspects was to take all control for communication from the local health departments and centralize it in Tallahassee. The messages then from Tallahassee are all political messages. They're all politicized. As a result, there is no capacity at the local health department to engage the community. The local health departments know exactly what is happening in the community. They have long-term relationships with the community. They work with the governmental entities in the community and the nonprofits in the community. And by taking away the capacity to communicate and work with the community, handcuffs public health. And it's even worse than that, because the messages coming from the Surgeon General, coming from the governor, are political messages. Now, it's almost unbelievable that the message from a Surgeon General would be to give parents the capacity to make decisions without giving parents the information they need to make those decisions. This Surgeon General came out and said that mRNA vaccines, which we depend on now, will result or could result in long-term impact on DNA. There is no scientific evidence to that point, and there's scientific evidence against that point. So it's not only the lack of opportunity to communicate, it's also disinformation that's being disseminated by this governor and by this Surgeon General that is creating the situation where we cannot protect or promote health in this state, and in particular in the local health departments. I want to make one other point that Paul made, and that is we have excellent, committed, passionate public health people in our communities, in particular in Duval County. It's not their issue. They are working as best as they can in an environment which makes it impossible for them to do their job.
We have a question from Mark on the South Side. Good morning, Mark. Welcome to the program.
Hey, good morning. I was listening to your conversation here, and I just happened to Google about migrants and measles and that kind of stuff. And it took me to a Chicago story. This is from NBC News on March 11th. And in their story, they show the number of measles cases in the United States over the past 24 years. In 2019, it says there were 1,274 cases of measles. In 2014, 667. Last year, there was like 58. And I'm just curious if y'all know why there was such a spike in those two particular years, because it's way out of every other year that I'm looking at over the past 24 years.
Dr. Goldhagen, is that a question that you know the answer to?
Well, so yes, there has been a period of time where there was anti-vaccination movement in the country. And we reached a nadir as far as vaccination coverage for measles, mumps, rubella, and so on and so forth. So those examples are perfect examples as to what happens when vaccination rates fall. And there were significant amounts of, I don't know, people remember an outbreak at Disney in California. And what lesson, Paul, it's mentioned, this state is a particularly vulnerable state because we have large numbers of people coming into the state as visitors, which means we should be having ongoing vaccine movements in the state to encourage vaccination, as opposed to anti-vaccine messages.
All right. We've got a call. Angela in St. John's. Good morning, Angela. Welcome to First Coast Connect.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I just really have a comment more than anything. My first child was born during an RSV outbreak, and we did not know that there was RSV in our community. This was not in the state of Florida, by the way. And my son ended up in the hospital for 7 days, and I cannot imagine having a newborn right now in Broward County with the health department treating this like it's no big deal, because these kids can get really sick. And if you are the parent of a newborn, your newborn does not have immunity to anything. And so if you carry your kid out and about around town, it's very easy to pick these things up. Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for your comment, Angela. I appreciate that. I want to return to Dr. Beisch. Can you give us an explanation? I'm not sure everybody knows the distinction between like what public health is as something separate and distinct from just medical care or health care in general.
Sure. Be happy to. Jeff indicated a little while ago that the functions are for public health are the number one is protection and promotion of health. But a big aspect of that is the policy making that he indicated earlier, but also it's about population health. And public health deals in data and information so that we can examine what's going on in the entire community. Whereas clinical medicine that all of us have practiced at one time or another, that's part of your medical education, is about individual one-on-one care. So when you're one of the roles that public health plays is assuring the health of the entire community. And if we go back to the beginning of this conversation, that's what's so concerning about for us about not engaging the community, but also about not protecting the public overall with the vaccine messages and the campaigns to increase vaccination rates. It's not protecting the community. It's not protecting families. And as the caller just said, it may potentially be exposing vulnerable individuals, members of the of our community, to pathogens like measles or RSV and other things that they may be susceptible to. So the public health makes plans for health. Jeff mentioned the TB hospital, and Paul did as well, that we lost some years ago. There were only a couple of TB hospitals in the entire country. They were doing a lot of research on how to treat TB. But public health often makes important contributions to control of contagious diseases, but also chronic diseases and injuries, environmental concerns, making sure we have clean water and air in our communities. So that's just a kind of a tip of the iceberg explanation.
We've got a question from John on Facebook. He says, does the MMR vaccine prevent measles? If yes, then who cares if parents choose not to vaccinate their kids? Parents who do choose will then have protected kids, unless, of course, the vaccine doesn't actually work. Yeah.
Yes. The measles vaccine is essentially 100% effective in preventing a child from getting the disease, it is to a certain extent it's a little callous to say, well, parents can decide whether they want their children to get the vaccine, and if in fact they don't, then so be it that the child gets sick, and as Paul said, the child can die from it. So. But the issue also is around herd immunity. And so we need at least 95% of the community to be vaccinated. Remember that measles vaccines doesn't start until the age of 4 or 5, which means all children between birth and age 4 and 5 are susceptible to the disease. If there is 95% of the community covered, the disease can't circulate. So it's not just about protecting those kids that aren't vaccinated and could be vaccinated. It's also about protecting other children before they can, in fact, be vaccinated.
And it's probably worth saying, I mean, that the kids who get this, you know, they get a cough, runny nose, conjunctivitis, they're very sick. I mean, it's a very miserable disease, rash, you know, full body rash. And in about 2 of 1,000 get some very serious diseases that can surface years later, including things that cause blindness, personality changes. I mean, it's not an insignificant illness. And, you know,
1 in 6 children actually end up in the hospital. Mm-hmm. So it's very serious.
And in terms of the overall vaccination rate.
Go ahead. I think we should clarify one thing. I think the vaccine guidelines are for 2 doses now. And the first one is at age one, I believe. So that there is some protection in those years, those childhood years leading up to school age. Mm-hmm. It's the second shot that confers the absolute immunity. But, and I also want to point out that this question about, well, okay, the kids that are vaccinated are going to be fine. And if a parent chooses not to vaccinate their child, that's on them. But there are immunocompromised individuals in our community. It's very important to achieve that kind of herd immunity that Dr. Goldhagen has referred to, so that people who are otherwise vulnerable, despite the availability of vaccine, are protected.
In terms of the herd immunity versus, you know, the overall vaccination rate, the CDC, as you say, recommends that, you know, 95% is what should be the minimum standard or the accepted standard. Duval County right now, I mean, they do, you know, periodically look at how many students in a given class. Seventh grade is one of those thresholds where they measure. And Duval County, according to the CDC, is just at 82.5% among seventh graders. That's the lowest in the state. And the Department of Health says that the rates in Duval are so low, it's actually, quote, affecting statewide out of compliance rates. And so it's a problem that we're seeing statewide in terms of low vaccination rates. But Duval is actually kind of at the forefront of that problem.
Correct. And I would ask you, and I'd ask our listeners to inform us as to what they've heard about getting the measles vaccine. What kind of measles vaccine campaign exists today in Duval County? And that's a sort of a rhetorical question, because in fact there is not an active measles vaccine campaign happening in Duval County and the surrounding counties, which is critically important to respond to this outbreak, but in particular, future outbreaks. The system needs to be in place in order to be able to protect, number one, but also to respond to these situations and other types of disasters, so to speak.
Well, to your point, last week, Jacksonville's chief health officer, Dr. Sunil Joshi, who's part of the city's effort to respond, he spoke last week to WJCT's Dr. Joe Servin. Let's listen to a little of what he had to say.
The reason why the vaccination came out in the first place is because of all of the health consequences people are getting from the measles, whether it's swelling of the brain, encephalitis, hospitalizations leading to pneumonia, lower respiratory tract infections. It was a devastating disease that the vaccine by itself has significantly reduced the consequences for.
Dr. Aaron, I want to ask you about that because, you know, to Dr. Goldhagen's point, this is not coming from the state health department or the local health department. This is coming from the city of Jacksonville. Is that in any way telling that it's kind of in their wheelhouse now to take up the mantle? And you know, to be clear, it wasn't offering a resource of places to get vaccines like the health department. He was just making a recommendation that parents see to it that their kids are vaccinated.
Yes, I think it's an important point that this doesn't just originate with public health, that in our society at large, there are social media campaigns and there's just a lot of conspiracy theories and misinformation that I think leads into this anti-vax atmosphere that we have that's even more of a challenge, and that I think it's the duty, the responsibility of public health to provide the accurate information and the recommendations. I think what we're seeing here in general, and this is sort of the intersection between the measles outbreak that we're talking about and the way Florida responded to the COVID epidemic, and that is that the current administration and Surgeon General have a philosophy of personal autonomy, which they link to public health. And I don't think those are two approaches that can be reconciled that way. Public health is not individual, personal autonomy decisions, even though it's very important to personal individual health status. It's community-based, and it has to do with protecting the community at large. And I think once you get into a sort of libertarian approach, you're not in public health anymore.
Mm-hmm. We have a question about Dr. Latipo, the Surgeon General, wondering if there have been any sanctions from the AMA. This is an email we got from Mark in Arlington. He says, what has the AMA done to sanction Dr. Latipo for his spreading disinformation that is grossly out of step with scientific findings? He has been the source of some controversy. He's actually even been lampooned by the New Yorker magazine. I think that they had an article joking that he was supporting reintroduction of leeches for, certain ailments. But certainly his COVID recommendations have been out of step with the mainstream of medicine, the CDC recommendations. But he remains a faculty member at the University of Florida, Dr. Goldhagen. He remains Surgeon General, and that's a political appointment.
Yeah, correct. The whole process of bringing Dr. Latipo into Florida was facilitated by the University of Florida. They provided him a tenured faculty position. They circumvented all routine recruitment processes. When he was recruited, he got his license within a couple of weeks. It takes most of us 6 months, and was Surgeon General within two to three weeks. So there's been no attempt by the University of Florida to censure him, to sanction him, or in fact to terminate him as a full-time University of Florida faculty member.
Do you think any of that would be appropriate?
Well, there have been a number of attempts to, in fact, push the administration to do that. They have pushed back, said that it's not their issue. And there's an irony here, whereas the University of Florida College of Medicine and university in general is a wonderful institution that I've spent 30 years as part of faculty member. The irony or the paradox is they push to expand their access to healthcare facilities, not the least of which is the new one here in Florida. At the same time, they are gutting and allowing public health to basically be diminished, resulting in directly and indirectly in the illness and deaths of thousands of people, tens of thousands of people in across Florida.
I want to take a quick call here from Eric in Arlington. Good morning, Eric. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, quick question. Should the state, in the form of the Department of Children and Families, take children away from parents who refuse to protect their children with vaccinations? Thanks for taking my call.
That's a strong suggestion, but I will turn that to you, Dr. Beisch.
Well, thank you for giving me that option. even though we've all said in one way or another that public health is about protecting the community, it's done not through, I think, rather draconian means that were just suggested, but rather through education and information. And where we've seen the great downfall in this administration is providing incorrect or misinformation. And so our first duty is certainly to inform and facilitate access to better health information, to facilitate access to vaccines. And again, we want to promote individual autonomy and decision-making, but we want to do it with information that protects the community and the collective. So, that would be the normal public health approach. But I also wanted to mention, and we've all said this one way or another, But public health, when it functions well, is apolitical. It's not, you know, we have certain types of public health in a red state or a blue state. It's apolitical. It's about protecting the community. And the culture of the health department or any other organization starts with the leadership, in this case, the governor's leadership and the surgeon general's leadership. And those and their leadership has been to undermine trust in governmental organizations. That leads to people questioning information and whether or not they should be vaccines. We're not advocating removing children from homes, certainly unless there's other reasons to do that. So thanks for giving me a shot at offering that explanation.
Thank you. Thank you for your answer. Dr. Ahrens, you led the state during its response in the HIV/AIDS crisis, which I think a lot of people in public health look as almost a golden age of public health in this state. But it has gotten increasingly difficult, I'll say, even as a member of the media, to get any answers of, you know, of the health department, certainly during COVID. But I remember even as far back as Zika, being unable to reach somebody at the local health department to provide an answer. How has that changed since when you were in charge of the HIV/AIDS response?
Well, and I'll put a little bit of a disclaimer there that I was the medical director in that bureau, and there was administrative leadership as well, overarching. But yes, I think, you know, Florida actually was on the cutting edge of legislation to both to fund the response to HIV and AIDS and also to protect individuals from stigma and discrimination related to HIV and AIDS. I think with some funding restrictions and during the 2010s, Florida actually returned prevention money to the federal government because of the unwillingness of the governor and the legislature to give budget authorization to spend the money. That's the kind of thing that has put Florida behind in the response to decrease the epidemic, because we certainly have ways now of preventing transmissions that we didn't have before. People who are adequately treated don't transmit HIV and so on. And last year, Florida had 4,606 newly reported cases of HIV. And compared to states like New York and California, which have pulled out all the stops in trying to end the epidemic, even Texas, our rates, new case rates per 100,000 are higher than those other highly impacted states. Yes, we're behind in our response. There is, in fact, during the during the Trump administration, a new initiative, a new federal initiative to end the HIV epidemic, to reduce new case reports by 90% by the year 2030 was put in place. We're not on the right trajectory to succeed in that in the state of Florida.
Thanks, Dr. Ahrens. I want to take a quick call before we have to wrap. We've got Kathy in Jacksonville. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. I am not anti-vax, but I do have some questions. There's a lot of heavy emphasis. You're talking about the measles, but what about the other vaccines? There seems to be a lot more children being vaccinated with more vaccinations than we had, say, 60s, 70s, and the early 80s. And also, how does the new definition of a vaccine with the mRNA play into the vaccinations that are now given to the children? Are these vaccines now changing? Thank you.
Great question, Kathy. I'm going to give that to you, Dr. Goldhagen, and then we're going to have to wrap. So just as briefly as you can.
Yes, it's a wonderful, wonderful thing that, in fact, now we can vaccinate against RSV and a host of other diseases. So that's a wonderful thing. mRNA technology is old technology. It's not new technology. We'll look forward to the opportunity in the future to benefit from that new technology.
Are we seeing more vaccinations overall than we used to?
Yes, yes. Not the least of which is an example of the RSV vaccine that's out now for kids and adults.
Okay, very good. Well, I want to thank you all for participating in this really important discussion, and we'll obviously continue with it. Dr. Feisch, Dr. Ahrens, Dr. Goldhagen, thank you all for being here today.
Thank you.
All right.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you. And we'll be right back with a new initiative that shines a light on the scenic and architectural gems in Arlington's landscape. Welcome back. The First Coast is rich in history and architectural treasures, but an area that is full of them is often overlooked. A new initiative aims to change that. Scenic Visions spotlights the life and history of areas outside Jacksonville's urban core. And I'm joined now by Scenic Jacksonville's Executive Director, Nancy Powell, and Director of Old Arlington Incorporated, Steve Matchett. Hey, welcome both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here. So what is Scenic Visions? This is a new initiative. It's targeting three neighborhoods. Is that right?
This year, it's targeting Arlington.
Okay.
And this is an outgrowth of the Great City Symposium, which Scenic Jacksonville hosts every year. And this year, it's on October 9th. That program brings in speakers from other cities to talk about downtowns and revitalization. So what we wanted to do is bring the conversation to the neighborhood level within Jacksonville, working with civic leaders. And we are thrilled this year to partner with Old Arlington, Inc. and several other civic organizations to bring you a spotlight on Arlington.
Mm-hmm. And I'm going to ask, what is the architectural and historical message that you would like to share about Arlington? Steve, it's a place that a lot of people are familiar with. A lot of people go shop there, but there's so much about it that people haven't maybe explored.
A lot of that's because they go down the Arlington Expressway uninterrupted, but have a different image of what Arlington really is. And this is part of what the series and the spotlight is trying to do, is highlight and showcase the assets of Arlington and other areas, the canopies. And our first episode is going to be, or event is going to be, a boat tour and to see Arlington from the river. And something that most people haven't seen in that regard. And there's a lot of beauty and a lot of history with Arlington that we're looking forward for the public to become more aware of.
And I think it's fair to say a lot of people move to Arlington because they're able to live on the water. There is so much waterfront. There is such a beautiful tree canopy.
There's also location, 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 which is really how Arlington's development came after the Matthews Bridge opened it up and its access to easy access to downtown beaches and what have you. But yes, the beauty of Arlington is attracting new people and the architecture, the mid-century modern architecture as well.
So that really is a selling point. I know in addition to the boat tour, Nancy, there's going to be a trolley tour that goes through the neighborhood and points out some of these architectural landmarks, really. I mean, there are some amazing hidden gems by some amazing architects. Tell us a little bit about who's there and what people should look for.
Well, Old Arlington is really the expert, and that's why we're partnering with them mm-hmm. on the hidden assets. But the Kona Skate Park is there, the Butterfly House. We also have Tree Hill. I'm going to let Steve talk mm-hmm. about some of the others. But that is looking at Arlington, you know, from the inside, whereas the boat tour is looking at it from the shoreline. And as we know, Arlington also has some challenges. So the intent about this series is to have meaningful conversations, experiential programs, so that people can experience the neighborhood, people who maybe haven't been there for a while, to come and see it. And then also then the third in the series is a panel discussion on May 29th at Jacksonville University.
And so there are some people like Taylor Hardwick, the mid-century modern resurgence is really, you know, kind of very current. And there is such a home for it there in Arlington. Bob Broward, talk about some of the pieces.
There's really some
history there.
Very. And the reason was because when the bridge opened, Arlington was pretty much just a few rural enclaves. There wasn't much. It was a blank canvas. And this was the time that the Taylor Hardwicks and the William Morgans and the Bob Browards were practicing. And so it became a blank canvas for them to do their work on. And Arlington has the richest collection of mid-century in Jacksonville. And we've featured it on annual home tours in the past. From the boat tour, you'll be able to see some of these as well. And a lot of the riverfront communities in Arlington were developed during this time and with mid-century modern architecture. It is a big attraction for people today because it's now become historic. It's over 50 years old and it's now protectable, and our preservation efforts are underway with that too.
That's an interesting landmark because, I mean, you look at Arlington, you can see a lot of history. You can also look at a time that sort of predates zoning laws as we would like to see them today, or any, you know, reasonable, cohesive, development in some areas. So what are some of those challenges that Arlington faces that are either kind of baked in historically because of some of the ways that it was designed, or that are current and new challenges?
Well, probably the best vehicle to express that all would be in the community redevelopment area. The Renew Arlington CRA plan adopted in 2015. The legislature doesn't hand out many of these anymore, and we are fortunate to have that in place. We're 7 or 8 years into it.
You mean CRAs, they don't hand out anymore?
Right, right.
And for people who don't know, that's kind of an opportunity to reinvest some tax dollars.
It is exactly right. It's incremental tax dollars are captured and then and spent in the Arlington area. And with that, that became, finally, we had a plan that had some funding behind it and some real work could be done. And that plan we were able to obtain it basically because Arlington was blighted. It had a statutory finding that of blight. And so a lot of that, as you mentioned, was because of zoning. We were not handed a good zoning palette from the county commission days and inherited some of that. And you still see scars of that today. And the CRA is going after the aesthetics, the fencing, landscaping, signage, in a first kind of attempt to kind of correct some of those mistakes of the past.
And so this focus on Arlington, there's the boat tour on March 23rd, there's the trolley tour on April 20th, and then the panel discussion, as you said, May 29th. And so this is an initiative of Scenic Jacksonville. How do you hope it moves forward? What is your goal, Nancy?
Well, we are in an advocacy organization, and we seek to improve the scenic beauty and character of Jacksonville. That's our focus. And so what we hope to do is spur civic action by people who maybe are in Arlington and haven't yet been involved. So that's where Old Arlington comes into play, as well as our other partners, Jack's Arlington Council, the Greater Arlington Civic Council, and Jacksonville University, and really improve the neighborhood.
Well, Nancy Powell and Steve Matcha, thank you so much for sharing this new endeavor. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Good,
thank you.
All right, and stick around. We'll be right back with the father of comedic baking and podcasts, stand-up comic Tom Papa.
The world takes you outside your borders and connects you with the most important events happening all across this big blue marble.
We introduce you to memorable people whose stories will stay with you for a lifetime. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Global news and inspiring voices that will keep you on top of the world.
Listen each weekday.
This afternoon at 3 here on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, chastity, poverty, obedience, and rebellion. We talk with Catherine Coldstream about her years in a Carmelite monastery, the beauty of the silence and prayer, and the loneliness when her idealism, intellectualism, and questioning were frowned on. After 10 years, she ran away. Her memoir is called Cloistered. Join us
today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
TikTok's been called the last sunny place on the internet, but the clouds are gathering.
The other, and I think broader concern, is the potential for this platform to be used for the propaganda purposes of the Chinese Communist Party.
Next time on 1A, we hear why the government is so concerned about the app and the pressure growing on its Chinese owners from both sides of the aisle.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
It can be hard to let your mind wander sometimes, to learn about something new, or to get fully engrossed in somebody else's story. That's where NPR comes in.
It takes a long time to create a fairy tale.
He was both a Jesuit priest and a jazz manager.
As soon as I saw the subject, I thought, oh my God, this is it.
Invest in deep, human storytelling today by giving to this station.
Please call 904-353-9528 and thanks.
And we're back. Comedian Tom Papa takes the stage at Pontevedra Music Hall on March 22nd as part of his Good Stuff tour. Good morning, Tom Papa. I want to thank you for not canceling on us. I've seen your bit on canceling, and I know from personal experience that canceling can be really satisfying.
Oh, there's nothing better in the world than canceling everything that you have.
You have had a long and storied career. You've got great specials on Netflix. You've acted in film, TV. You've got an amazing podcast. Talk a little bit about just sort of the nature of your humor and how you're able to spread it across so many mediums.
Well, thank you very much. It's very nice of you to say. I think I just kind of live my life and try and come up with the funny stuff that I see and send it back to people. And my life is pretty much family-based. You know, I come from a big family. I made a big family, and I find families are like this little microcosm of the bigger picture. It's like anything that goes on in your house, any arguments you have, anything that drives you crazy, everyone can relate to it. And it's what I love to talk about.
You really incorporate your own interests and passions in the work that you do. And I think specifically of the podcast, for people who may not have heard it, describe a little bit what the conceit is of the Breaking Bread and why that's something that you personally, you know, are very interested in.
Yeah, it's called Breaking Bread with Tom Papa. And it's a podcast I've been doing for a while now. And it incorporates my love of comedy and talking to new, interesting, creative people. And also my love of food. I'm a big bread baker. I started baking bread about 8 years ago and making sourdough bread. And I really got into it. And I found that every time I sit with somebody or give the bread to somebody, they would open up. When you sit down with people and you share food, it kind of brings up these memories. It's sensual, it's thought-provoking, and it's just a kind of a good, friendly way to get into a podcast, into any discussion, but then into the podcast is the way that I kind of framed it. So every time someone comes on the podcast, I give them a loaf of my bread, and then we just start our conversation.
So you were actually baking sourdough before baking sourdough was cool.
Yes, 100%. When the pandemic hit and all these people started baking bread, I felt like someone who was into a band in the early days, and then they became popular. I was like, you guys, I was there in the beginning. I'm a real fan. That's how I felt with the bread. I was like, as soon as the stores open up, you're all going to go buy your bread again, and I'll still be baking.
So what is your current tour like? What can people who come to see you in Pontevedra at the concert hall there expect to see?
It's just a really good time. And I kind of feel like I feel like it's a great escape from what's going on out in the world. I mean, we have lots of places where you can listen about politics and horrible news and all of the anxiety of modern day life. But I've been saying recently that I feel like when you come to my show, it's like you've been at a party and it's really getting loud and a little out of control. And you know how you wander away from the party down the hall just to catch your breath and you go into that room where they keep all the coats That's how I feel like my show is. You come in, you're with good people, you have a good time, and you catch your breath before you go back out to your life.
I actually have a lot of memories of going into the coat room to sleep, like at adult parties. People go into the coat room these days to kind of check their phone. So they're not, they're just doing this now, not to check their phone, but to actually have a little time away from the insanity.
Yeah, exactly. There's something magical about the coat room.
So you've done writing for New Yorker magazine, which is just such an aspiration for so many people in the world. How does doing that kind of content differ from, I don't know, writing books, producing stand-up, the other stuff that you do?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think all of my, it's all funny. It's all humor-based. But there are definitely things that I find topics and things I want to talk about that go into the stand-up act. You know, those are like kind of shorter, more punchier things. And then things that go into the books, which you kind of expand a little bit more on. And the New York articles are closer to the books than they are to the stand-up. I mean, they have to be funny, but you also stretch out a little bit more. It's definitely, I think writing the books and writing, my books are compilations of essays. And I think it got me into essay writing a little better than I had before. And that lent itself to the New Yorker stuff a little bit more. I really like it. I mean, there's nothing cooler than seeing that New Yorker title over your essay. You're right. It's something if you write or if you like that kind of a thing, it's definitely a high watermark.
Sure. Just seeing your name in that typeface, I think would be pretty exciting.
Yeah.
Are there other projects that you've got coming down the pike? I feel like you are, I don't want to say spread thin, but you do so much already. Or is the path ahead just kind of steady as it goes?
Yeah, I just kind of take it as it comes. I'm working hard on this stand-up right now. I'm doing a lot of dates on tour because this is all leading up to the next taping of my next Netflix special in June. So this whole tour that I've been working on, this act, and now it's pretty set. Now I'm just having fun with it, but it's I'm doing a lot of dates all leading up to this next Netflix special. So I've got all the jokes down. Now I just have to figure out what I'm going to wear.
Oh, awesome. Well, whatever your sartorial choice, we'll be glad to see you when you get here. Friday, March 22nd, you can see Tom Papa at the Pontevedra Concert Hall. Tickets are still available. You can get them at floridatheater.com or pvconcerthall.com. Comedian Tom Papa, thank you so much for chatting with me today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
And that's our program. We encourage you to send feedback or suggestions to First Coast Connect at wjct.org. And if you missed anything, you can catch our rebroadcast at 8 o'clock tonight or find our entire archive at wjct.org and on your favorite podcast platform. Join us again tomorrow for our monthly Ask the Mayor session with Jacksonville Mayor Donna Deegan. I'm Ann Schindler, and you've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.